Wow, look at that. Oh, look at all of you. Hi. So once again this week, I thought about just throwing out my talk and spending this whole time talking about the flood. And then I went back and looked at the story of Joseph that I'd wanted to use today, and it turns out that story makes exactly the point I would have made about the flood. So I'll tell you what it is, so you can watch for it in Joseph's story. Over and over again, events that appeared terribly unfair to Joseph and problems that seemed insurmountable led to good. In the wake of our flood or any disaster or loss, I know it sounds glib to say, well, good will come out of this. But here it is. In the earliest stories of the Bible, human beings have known this for thousands of years. Don't be too quick to label something as bad. Wait to see how it all turns out. So we've been tracing the early Hebrew history through its dysfunctional families. These were the first families created by God, so we can't really complain about ours. We are now near the end of the book of Genesis. One of the interesting ways to read the Bible is to watch how their concepts of God change. Just within the length of Genesis, we see God backing off. He's no longer a character in the story. We started this series with Cain and Abel, where God shows up. After Cain kills his brother Abel, God comes and asks him, "Where's your brother?" And that's when Cain famously says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" The week after that, we heard Abraham having regular conversations with God. God promised him the land of Canaan. He told him his descendants would cover the earth. He promised him a baby at 100 years old. Later, Abraham heard God's voice telling him to sacrifice his son Isaac, and then telling him, "Never mind." Isaac's son, Jacob, met God in dreams and visions. He wrestled with an angel. So first God came down in person, and then he was a voice. Then he communicated in visions and dreams. By this point, they talked about God. They saw God at work in their lives. They gave God credit for good, actually for bad as well. But God was not in the room anymore. And at the same time, God seemed to be backing off. We see humans taking more responsibility as co-creators, not just obeying, but participating. So when we left Jacob last week, he had 11 sons. He went on to have 12. They headed the 12 tribes of Israel. But number 11 was special. That was Joseph, Dad's favorite, because he was the first child, finally, from Joseph's beautiful wife, Rachel. I mean, Jacob's wife. You remember Jacob worked 14 years to be able to marry her. And Jacob's favoritism of Joseph was blatant, symbolized in the story by this special coat. Joseph was 17 by now. He worked as a shepherd with the family's flocks. Apparently, he was a charismatic kid, handsome, charming. Everyone loved him except his 10 older brothers. So you remember, Jacob's name had been changed to Israel when he wrestled with the angel. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children because he was the son of his old age. And he had made him a long robe with sleeves. The translation here is unclear. Long sleeves, coat of many colors. The point is, this was something special. Jacob had made it himself, and he gave it only to Joseph. But when his brothers saw that their father loved Joseph more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Once Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream that I dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, and your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. Joseph had another dream and told it to his brothers, saying, "Look, I've had another dream. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What kind of dream is this that you've had? Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow to the ground before you? So his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Oh my gosh, God, Dad is taking this seriously. He's thinking, maybe we should bow down to Joseph. Because he'd been raising Joseph as a cultured man, he'd been grooming him to take over. No wonder his brothers hated him. So the 10 brothers took the flocks out to a faraway pasture somewhere near Dothan, and Dad asked Joseph to go check on them. He went by himself. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we'll say a wild animal has devoured him, and we'll see what becomes of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, Reuben is the softy brother, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him." So Reuben was planning to come back and get Joseph and take him home. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it, the Bible specifies. So the brothers sat down to eat lunch, and they noticed a caravan coming their way, which was not unusual. This was a trade route. And a light bulb went off for brother Judah. "Let's not kill him. Let's sell him." So they sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver. Brother Judah, 20 pieces. In the New Testament, it's Judas, 30 pieces. There's some inflation over 1,000 years. The brothers kept the Technicolor dream coat. They dipped it in goat's blood and took it back to their father and said, "Look what we found in the wilderness. Do you recognize this?" Well, Jacob, Israel, assumed immediately that Joseph had been killed by wild animals, and he mourned and he wailed and he could not be consoled. Meanwhile, this caravan headed into Egypt, and the traders eventually sold Joseph again to Potiphar, who was the captain of the guard for the Pharaoh. Joseph was still charming. People were drawn to him. Potiphar put him in charge of his whole household, all his business affairs. So being thrown in a pit and sold as a slave led to good. Potiphar, this captain of the guard, had a wife. We never know her name. According to the Bible, the wife seduced Joseph. Okay, he was 17 years old. He was buff. He was charming. I mean, can you imagine the, you know, tan skin, white smile? He was a... Sorry. Okay, I got a little distracted. He was a shepherd, which is their equivalent of a cowboy. And what? And he was a Hebrew, which was forbidden fruit. Since then, I've discovered another version of this story in Islam. You know, we share Abraham as the father of our religions, and we have many of the same stories, but they're told differently in the Quran. So in their version, Potiphar's wife has a name, Zuleika. She was very beautiful, and Joseph was very attracted to her. Their love story is told at Muslim weddings. Many Muslim girls are named Zuleika. They did not have an affair. She was a strong temptation for Joseph, but he did the right thing. So this is seen as a coming-of-age story about Joseph. In our version, Potiphar's wife is an evil seductress. She represents other, different race, different class, different sex, and Hebrews must shun anything other. And the Hebrews wrote our Bible. So in our story, she says, "Lie with me." But in our story too, Joseph resists her. He spurns her. He flees, actually leaving his garment in her hand. He just slips out of it and runs. I think he's learning that charm and good looks can have consequences. He's growing up. He's learning how to handle himself. Well, Potiphar finds out about all of this. And in our version, the wife falsely accuses Joseph of rape, attempted rape, and Potiphar throws him in jail. The head warden is so charmed by Joseph, he puts him in charge of the jail. So once again, bad things turn out well, or at least okay. I mean, he is in jail. And years go by. A couple of Pharaoh's servants get thrown into the cell with Joseph, and he interprets dreams for them. That's his superpower. He predicts one of them will live and the other will die, and he's right. One is hanged and the other one goes back to work for the Pharaoh. And Joseph says to the servant who's being freed, ever the charmer, please do me the kindness to make mention of me to the Pharaoh, and so get me out of this place. But the servant doesn't do it. Maybe he forgets, or he's just seen the other guy hanged and he's not wanting to chat with the Pharaoh right now. But two more years go by, and the Pharaoh has a dream, two dreams actually. In the first one, sleek, fat cows are being eaten up by skinny, ugly cows. And in the second one, plump ears of corn are devoured by scrawny, dry ears of corn. None of the wise men in the land can interpret Pharaoh's dream. And the servant now sees his chance to make points with the Pharaoh. So he tells him about this guy he knew in jail who could interpret dreams. And Joseph is brought into the palace. The Pharaoh says, I've heard you can interpret dreams. And Joseph says, it is not I. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So you hear some growth in Joseph. He's 30 years old by now. He's not trying to be such a hot shot. He recognizes his gift and he knows it comes from God. And he says both dreams mean the same thing. It represents 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine in Egypt. And he has a suggestion. During the 7 years of plenty, store up 1/5 of all the grain, 20%. And the Pharaoh says, that is a great idea. I just need someone to run a program like that. And Joseph says, yeah, you would need someone discerning and wise who could be in charge of all of Egypt. And the Pharaoh says, can we find anyone like that? One in whom is the Spirit of God? And then he looks right under his nose at Joseph, who has brilliantly interpreted his dreams. And the Pharaoh says, there's no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only with regard to the throne shall I be greater than you. Removing his signet ring from his hand, Pharaoh put it on Joseph's hand. He arrayed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in the chariot of his second in command, and they cried out in front of him, bow the knee. Thus Pharaoh set Joseph over all the land of Egypt. Does this guy lead a charmed life or what? Yesterday he was in jail. Stranger in a strange land, wildly successful. So let's apply this to us. Imagine that an American president tells us he's going to levy a 20% additional tax, 1/5 of everything we produce, because he had a dream that a crash is coming. And the person he's chosen as the czar to oversee this new tax program is, say, a Mexican immigrant who's just been released from jail. It might not go over well politically, but when you're Pharaoh, you don't have to worry about public opinion. This story has been an inspiration to immigrants for thousands of years now, especially Jews as they scattered around the world. It's the story of an immigrant who becomes successful wherever he happens to land. Bad always leads to good for Joseph. He was thrown in a pit and taken to Egypt and put in charge of Potiphar's estate. He was falsely accused and thrown into jail, but eventually he meets Pharaoh and he's put in charge of Egypt with a ring on his hand and a gold chain around his neck. Joseph never comes off as a victim. We never hear him complain. He seems to practice non-resistance. When you look back over the events of his life, you can't imagine his success without the hardships. Each step was necessary to the process, and he knew that. During the 7 years of plenty, Joseph married a priest's daughter and had two sons and gave them interesting names. Manasseh meant God has made me forget all my hardship. And Ephraim means fruitful. He said, "For God has made me fruitful in the land of my misfortunes." We know the worst situations can be redeemed for good. Whatever comes into our lives brings gifts eventually. There may be a long, terrible period that is not fun or easy or pleasant, and it might include mud and destruction and power outages and bridge detours. Just consider that it's all necessary to the process so we can be fruitful in the land of our misfortunes. The 7 years of plenty come to an end, and sure enough, famine begins. There's famine everywhere, including Egypt and in all the surrounding countries. But all this food is stored in Egypt. Joseph is in charge of it, and people are coming from all over the immediate world for this food. Nearby Canaan, which is north of Egypt, they're hungry and suffering, and Joseph's brothers and his father Jacob still live there. So his 10 older brothers come to Egypt to ask for food. They leave their kid brother Benjamin at home with their old dad. Joseph recognizes his brothers, but they don't know him. The story is ultimately about how he forgives them, but he has some fun with them first. He speaks Egyptian through an interpreter, so they don't know he can understand what they're saying. He's very harsh. He throws them in jail for 3 days. And even though they don't know who Joseph is, they make the karmic connection. They know they're being punished for that time they sold their brother and lied to their father. Joseph lets them out of jail, but he sends them back home to bring Benjamin, son number 12. Benjamin is Rachel's other son. He's Joseph's full brother. And he was just a child when Joseph disappeared. So they leave again, and they come back with the kid brother. And through all of this, Joseph sees they really are good guys. And Joseph could no longer control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, "Send everyone away from me," which means, "Could we have the room, please?" So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. But he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, so dismayed were they at his presence. "We thought you were dead." And then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come closer to me." And they came closer. And he said, "I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." And then he fell on their necks, and everyone wept, and there was a big group hug. Joseph was in exactly his right place, and he knew it. His purpose was to save lives during this famine. He warned his brothers there were still 5 years of famine yet to come, and he invited them to move to nearby Goshen, land of Goshen, in the Nile River Valley, because it was normally very fertile farmland. So they went home one more time, and they brought everybody back. They brought their old father Jacob, all their families. So here are 11 brothers, each with several wives, all their children, all their servants, all their livestock. This huge tribe comes down to Egypt, and the Pharaoh himself comes out to greet them on Joseph's behalf, and they settle in the land of Goshen. So you could say it's pretty easy for Joseph to forgive his brothers because of how well his life turned out in spite of them, or maybe it turned out so well because of them. As Joseph said himself, how would he have succeeded if misfortune hadn't put him in the right place at the right time? Maybe it was all perfect. So there's one last part to this story I hadn't noticed before. The famine got worse every year. The people of Egypt and the surrounding countries kept coming to Joseph, and they would give anything for food. They were starving. So first year they gave all their money. And the next year, they gave all their livestock in return for the stored grain. Next year, they gave their land. And then they offered themselves as slaves. So all of Egypt was owned by the Pharaoh, including the people. And they were grateful they could trade themselves for food. I'm not saying they should have starved to death. But when are you offering too much of yourself for something you think you'll die without? The Hebrews ended up enslaved and grateful for it because they could subsist on what was handed out. When do we settle for too little and enslave ourselves. This slavery included Joseph's brothers. They were the nation of Israel. They were fruitful and prolific, 12 tribes, and their descendants became the Hebrew slaves in Egypt, who were brutalized by a later Pharaoh. The Bible calls him the Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. Until Moses came and said, "Let my people go," and led them back to Canaan, the promised land. Joseph made a trip back to Canaan too, long before Moses and the Exodus. He returned to bury his father Jacob in his original home. And the rabbis tell a story that on the way back to Canaan, Joseph stopped at the pit where his brothers had thrown him, and he blessed it. Now that their father was dead, though, the brothers started to worry that Joseph might turn on them after all. But Joseph said, "Do not be afraid. Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good." The King James says, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." Meaning, good can come out of anything. Joseph lived the rest of his long life in Egypt. He died there and he was revered. And when the Hebrew slaves finally made their exodus with Moses, they carried the bones of Joseph out of Egypt with them to bury in the promised land. So ultimately, I think this is a very comforting story in our time of flood and destruction. Joseph met the events in his life with non-resistance. He could say at the end, it was all for good. It had all been guided by God. He could bless the pit where he'd been thrown. He could give his children names of optimism and overcoming. He could forgive his brothers because God's grace superseded their harmful intent. Joseph led a charmed life, but we all are charmed. The universe is biased in our favor. That's what grace is. Things generally turn out all right. Well-being is predominant on the earth. Most of the time, everything's fine. And when it's not, the best prayer I know is, "Show me the good." Because it is there. So in the flood this week, we've seen so much good. The armies of volunteers who came to help. Some waded through mud to help strangers, some cooked, some answered phones, some just kept information up to date, which was crucial. Lots and lots of people gave money. But here's the thing. The gifts are not necessarily in the circumstance. The best gifts occur within you. Peace, growth, happiness, acceptance. You can have those gifts even when nothing outside of you changes. I'll bet during this massive cleanup there have been moments of laughter or gratitude or even tears from being so touched by what people are willing to do. As Ram Dass said, we're all just walking each other home. So let's take these thoughts into meditation.
Let's just breathe. That there is a power for good in the universe. That power that no matter how many ways or words we use to try to describe it, the one that we continually come back to, is love. And we are created in that love. We are here expressing as that love in and through us, as us. And what I know is that everyone present in this room today, in this community, those we hold in mind today, and we hold in heart especially, are here as divine expressions of that love. And particularly in this time, showing up in the most incredible ways. I know that everyone here is the face of God, the hands of God, the hearts of God. The home of God. What I know is that we are also sometimes moved. Moved way, way beyond our comfort zones. We are shocked into doing nothing else but being that expression of love. And what I know is that everyone present in this room today as that expression of God, of divine light, is awake. We are awake and aware. And we are most particularly awake and aware to the fact that we are not ever, ever alone. We have never been abandoned. We have never been betrayed. We have never been thrown into a pit. Because that power that is in us and as us lifts us. Continually. It shakes us and wakes us to be more, to be our greatest expression in this lifetime, on this planet. We are indeed here by divine appointment. We've got a lot of work to do. And we also have so much gratitude to give that we are here, that we are awake, we are alive, we are aware. And as Meister Eckhart said, if there is only one prayer that we can ever utter, thank you would be enough. So let's take a deep, deep, deep breath. I am grateful and I speak this word of gratitude, knowing that all is indeed well. And we walk. walk through this with gratitude and with love, nothing can get in the way. So please, if you would, take just those big, deep cleansing breaths, and please share with me the Alleluia. Alleluia.